ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option, that it's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you remember that video that went viral of that drone picking up a sausage sandwich outside a hardware store during COVID lockdowns? These little flying machines have acquired rather more ambitious career plans of late. They're heading into unexplored caves on the moon. They're hunting other drones over Ukraine, patrolling beneath the ocean, and for a time, they were delivering food in Melbourne. So how did we get from flying cameras to autonomous machines that can fight wars, deliver dinner, and potentially fill our skies? And how much of this future is Australia prepared for? My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Joining me now to unpack some of the biggest stories in drones right now and why they matter for all of us is Corey Alpert, who is a researcher at the University of Melbourne, a former Biden White House staffer. He's also spent the last few months in Ukraine. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
And Lee Stark, technology journalist from picker.com.au. Welcome back, Lee.
Thank you for having me as well.
Now, drones have evolved, it's fair to say, from these basic tiny camera-carrying quadcopters to autonomous machines exploring places humans cannot reach. How much can today's drones do without a human controlling them?
More than you'd like to admit, in a way that's kind of scary at certain things. We have AI that can actually allow them to monitor the outside world, to basically respond to not just motion sensors, but also depth. And so they can fly by themselves. They can effectively fly to specific locations. And when they run out of battery, they can also crash by themselves.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Corey, how does a drone know where it is?
So drones have lots of sensors. They have GPS or the equivalent geolocation technology on them. But they're also pulling in from cameras and from other sensors about their height, the wind speed, and all of that. So they have on board, they have a pretty good approximation of exactly where they are across the world and in terms of their height and space in the air or in the water.
So how have drones gotten so much better so quickly? Because I think about the drones of even, 5-10 years ago, they were nowhere near as capable as they are today. What has been the major change that's happened?
The rise of the AI industry has given these drones a software backing they never had before. Before this massive AI boom and the commercial boom that has allowed these AI companies to really flourish, these drones were largely driven by human pilots who would control one drone at a time from sort of a remote control ground base. But now that you have drones that can fly by themselves, can make decisions on their own, and beyond what Lee was saying, in warfare, they can actually choose their targets on their own and then adjust and follow as those targets move. So it's the autonomous software behind them that has really driven this revolution in the technology.
One of the more incredible stories that I've seen lately is that NASA wants to send a drone into caves on the moon. Lee, can you tell me about this plan?
I can't tell you anything about that plan, to be honest.
Oh!
I know nothing about that plan.
Oh, Corey, can you tell me a little bit about this plan?
A little bit. So one of the challenges that NASA or any space agency has on the moon is there's about a 7-minute lag between when they send a message and when it's received on the moon. So the idea actually comes from drones, again, used in warfare, where if you have a drone that is able to autonomously move and within a given set of parameters for what it needs to do, they could send a drone that then doesn't have to rely on that 7-minute lag to make decisions about where to go.
That's kind of incredible because if you're sending a drone to the moon, it doesn't have GPS or any of the traditional navigations that we rely on Earth. So how does that work?
Again, using those cameras, I assume they will have some kind of sensor that's updated from Earth-based technology, what a phrase, to understand where it is spatially in regard to the, you know, the ground and the walls of the cave. I assume those will be visual or echolocation or something in that space. But it will essentially operate by figuring out where the walls of the space are and then mapping it in real time and navigating through.
You could use LiDAR for that. So on the back, your phone has a perfect example of that. So if you've got a recent phone, you've got a LiDAR sensor on the back, which is effectively a depth sensor. It just kind of bounces off of walls to work out where they are. So it's more than likely going to bounce off of whatever looks like a shaded object in front of it.
So it's like a bat.
Yes, it's going to be a bat. It's going to be a bat that explores the moon. That clearly needs its own logo and theme song.
I love that we have a GPS global positioning system. We might end up in the future with a MPS, a moon positioning system, or a lunar positioning system. That's kind of incredible. So if I, you know, regular person, not planning to visit the moon with it, not planning to go to war with it, were to go and buy a drone tomorrow, Lee, what am I actually allowed to do with my drone in Australia?
Yeah, so it depends on the type of drone. So you've got these really tiny personal drones that you can technically fly inside your own home and hope they don't knock around every bit of furniture and basically like a cat, they'll push everything out. So those sorts of drones exist. Most people don't buy them. They're not necessarily handy. If you buy a regular drone, you have to go somewhere else. You have to usually go out of the city limits. So you can't technically fly it. In most parts of Sydney where we're filming, you've got to go find rules on the CASA website, the Civil Aviation Authority, and you have to find where you're allowed to fly them, because outside of that, you can basically have that drone removed from you if you try.
I do see a lot of people flying drones in national parks. I do a lot of bushwalking, and you do think that you're hearing a bee or a swarm of wasps or something, and someone's got a drone, but that's usually not allowed, right?
That's not technically allowed, but some places are. It depends on how far you go. So some national parks probably won't have a problem depending on how close they are to the city. But for example, you have to have a license and a lot of permission if you wanted to fly it, say, around Sydney Harbour. So most people, you go buy a drone today, you're probably not going to fly it around here. You're going to have to drive quite a fair bit away. But certain parts of rural Australia, you'd have no problems.
One of the things that piqued my interest a little while ago was there was an organisation called Wing that was organising food delivery. It felt like a bit of a trial in Melbourne. And then it just kind of disappeared. I didn't hear much about it anymore. Can I get food delivered by drone, Lee?
You can't at the moment. My understanding of Wing is it's kind of largely fizzled. It was a combination between Google and an Australian company that were actually building it. And for a while, it worked around Melbourne, Canberra, and parts of Queensland. So you could order lunch from a nearby shopping centre and it would be able to deliver it to you. You could order groceries that way. It's kind of cool. But it was more or less a test. It was a concept that kind of lasted about a year. And now we just kind of look at it as it was a successful test. But if you go to even places like America, you can actually find Domino's using delivery sort of drones as well. They're more like remote control ovens, I'll be completely honest. They're like a remote control oven, less a drone. But because drones are not just flying, they're also as by water and by land, it's technically a drone that can deliver your pizza to your door.
Corey, do you think that there will be a future where the kind of delivery that we do see in the US, the prevalence of drones just sharing the footpath with regular people, do you think that that will become normal in Australia?
I do. On university campuses across the United States, a lot of food delivery is done by these ground-based drones. My brother was at the University of Tennessee a couple years ago, and even two or three years ago, most food delivery to dorm rooms was done with these drones that could sort of crawl along the sidewalks and actually go in elevators and go all the way to a student's room. I do think that kind of convenience is something that people are going to crave, and it's something that we're going to have to figure out how to work. The other element of this is those drones at some point are going to become significantly cheaper than human delivery workers. Mm. And that market pressure, I think, is what's going to drive this.
I think that's why people have been kicking them over. The robots are literally taking people's jobs, even if they are gig economy, underpaid jobs.
Look, they're not as easy to talk to in the elevator on your way up. They don't make as much as good a small talk.
And what happens? I'm now thinking about just things with drones going wrong. Who is liable if one of these delivery drones, you know, runs over our cat in our driveway?
It's funny you mention a cat, because that is actually the first lawsuit that is coming through in the United States.
You're kidding.
Is in San Francisco, where I used to live, there are lots of driverless vehicles now. They are largely beginning to supplant the Uber and taxi industry across the city. But about a year ago, one of these vehicles swerved and hit a quite beloved street cat who had its own, you know, Instagram account and was well-known in the community, swerved and killed this cat. And so now there are community lawsuits that are coming through that are essentially asking the question of who is responsible when one of these machines makes a decision that ends up taking a life. And that's a question that is no one really knows how to answer it. The companies themselves don't necessarily hard code the decision between what the car should do, but no one right now is responsible, but our law requires some kind of responsibility to move anything forward. So that case, I think, will be one of the first that decides if the company's responsible or ultimately if no one's responsible.
It does make sense to me that the person who created the technology should be responsible for what that technology does, especially if it's been programmed to make decisions.
The problem of that is when we say programmed to make decisions, I mean, so the company at that point as opposed to the person, but the problem when we say programmed to make decisions is that an AI making decisions about what's integral for the occupant of the car is kind of where that would be going to. And as Corey said, AIs, they make decisions, but they come from a variety of different points, not just a black or a white answer of I'm not going to hit that cat because it might save my occupant's life. It's a maybe I didn't see the cat, maybe it appeared at the wrong time, maybe the sensors didn't send the information at the exact moment. So there's so many different variables on this where you could say technically the AI wasn't at fault, even though the cat, it can go in so many directions. So I can totally see why Corey is saying that this will be the sort of case that tests it all, because it's the AI's fault, but it's also not the AI. There's so many factors there.
And the AI can't explain itself. This is the other big part of it. Unlike a human that you can sit on the witness stand, there's nothing you can do to tell the AI will explain your decision. It can't.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And Ukraine has transformed drones from useful military gadgets to a central part of modern warfare. Corey, what has changed on the battlefield because of drones?
So the war in Ukraine has essentially become a battle of these autonomous weapons. Both sides, Russia and Ukraine, are sending swarms of drones, about 1,000 per day on certain days, back and forth at each other. This is now the weapon of choice for this war.
So what does a drone operator actually do?
So right now, drone operators will be able to fly one drone, but by the end of the year, drone operators, because of this autonomous technology, will personally be able to direct an entire swarm of drones. So, you know, between 1 and 500 drones or more with a single controller. And so what they're doing is they are picking a target and then essentially setting the drone on a course to say, this is the kind of thing that we want you to target, and then letting the drone's autonomous software move. The reason the autonomous software is really developed in Ukraine is because Russia jams the cellular signal that each drone is using, and so the autonomous software moves around that. So once that signal begins to jam, the drone itself can then make a decision without having to then speak back to headquarters or home base.
Okay, and one of the things that we're hearing a lot about is the cost of these drones, that they are low cost and therefore there can be a lot of them. Why is it the cheap ones that are so useful?
Because they're expendable. In Ukraine, the military budget, at least compared to Australia or obviously to the United States, is very little. And to send a fleet of 1,000 drones costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000, where a single Patriot missile, one of the sort of staples of defense across the Western world, is between $3 and $5 million. So the entire industry has really moved away from, or is moving away from, single large elements into having entire fleets of very small, very agile elements that can be that can be expended very quickly.
Corey, do you think that people are misunderstanding or underestimating the impact of drone warfare?
I do, but I think it's in a slightly different direction than I think where most defense analysts are going. The question here isn't if drone technology can easily replace a Patriot missile or a tank or something like that. The question is becoming, in defense circles, how quickly can you produce new versions of this technology? These drones are changing all the time. A few weeks ago, I was in a warehouse in the outskirts of Kyiv where they were developing drones that could intercept much larger Russian missiles and Russian loitering munitions, which are sort of like drones. They are developing these technologies quite quickly, and they're changing all of the time. And so the change that I think drones are forcing on the defense industry is moving it away from having mass production of single large elements to being able to change what these factories do essentially overnight.
Are these drones easy to target and destroy?
The drones themselves are fairly easy to target and destroy. I mean, like Lee was talking about, these are essentially the quadcopters that you can buy on Amazon or buy at another store. They've just been adapted with much more advanced technology and usually a weapon underneath. So they are very easy to knock down one by one, which is why they send hundreds or thousands all at once. The typical Russian attack pattern in Ukraine right now is that they'll send 600 to 1,000 drones in a night, knowing that 800 or 900 of them will get shot down, but there are only so many defense mechanisms you can use, and eventually a couple will get through.
That's kind of incredible. I can't even imagine being in a situation where you wake up in the middle of the night and there are 600 to 1,000 drones overhead. You know, we're talking earlier about the noise of just one of them. Mm. So that must be an incredible experience. Did you witness anything like that while you were there?
Of course. In Kyiv, this is just about once a week. So the Russian drones sound a lot like lawnmowers. In Ukrainian, the word actually translates to moped for what the Russians use as drones. And that's exactly what they sound like. And you hear them overhead, and there's sort of a psychological reaction that you now know that there is a bomb flying over your head that, when that engine stalls, could dive down and destroy anything around it. So that is omnipresent anywhere in Ukraine. But in Kyiv, those attacks are about once a week. And these days, those attacks start at about 1 a.m. or so. So you get a pretty good ear as you're sleeping for when those attacks come in, and then you have to make decisions beyond that to keep yourself safe.
Thinking about what it is that these drones will be doing when they're deployed, and also the fact that these are the cheap ones that you can get from Amazon. Yeah, how precise do they need to be? Lee, how precise are these cheap drones able to be when they're being controlled, do you think?
They're not likely to be that precise, but my guess, Corey, is they probably don't have to be. As long as they crash on something and explode, the precision's probably irrelevant at that point.
Generally, yes. So there are two types of drones being used in warfare right now. They're sort of the larger drones, the loitering munitions that don't have to be very precise, that essentially, you know, you send them on a direction and they more or less go towards the right neighborhood or the right street corner. But then there are the smaller FPV drones, first-person view drones. Those are the ones with cameras on them. And those, there was a story out of Ukraine just a couple of weeks ago, where a fully autonomous drone, so from takeoff to flight to targeting, was entirely autonomous, no human in the loop, that then followed a Russian soldier and killed a Russian soldier autonomously. That involved chasing that Russian soldier through a field and, I believe, a house. So that's the level of granularity that these cameras and these sensor systems are able to get for how they're able to follow and track targets.
That's not terrifying at all,
yeah. Just
listening to that.
Corey, I don't think it can be understated how terrifying it must be to be effectively hunted down by an autonomous robot drone. The fact that this isn't a future scenario, it's a current one, does that concern you?
It does. And it concerns every frontline soldier that I speak with. You know, I was out near the front line, and nearly every soldier has had this experience. For the most part, those experiences have been over the last 2 or 3 years in which there's a human on the backside of that flying a drone from a remote controller. But now you have a lot of soldiers much more aware that there's not even a human on the other side of that anymore, that these are human soldiers being chased down by machines. This is sort of the nightmare scenario of science fiction movies from, you know, the 70s to the 2000s that's now happening in real time on the front lines of this conflict.
Corey, science fiction always paints this as being quite traumatic, but science fiction almost always paints the idea that an EM pulse would be able to knock out something from the sky. Does anyone try this? I mean, it would probably affect their own hardware, but can an EM pulse knock them out?
I would assume, but again, this is a war where this is the main weapon on both sides. If you had an electromagnetic pulse that was able to attack anything here, that would affect your own side as well. Both sides are using incredibly complicated autonomous systems to fly these drones, and again, many thousands of them. If you set off an EMP, you've now limited your entire capacity to attack the other side.
Now, Corey, you've given us some audio of what these drones sound like. Can you tell me what you've sent to us and explain what it is that we're listening to?
So one of these files is sort of the ambient sound of what a drone sounds like just when you're walking around Kyiv at night, although the curfew is midnight. The drones are overhead, and that is sort of the lived reality every day or every week for anyone living in Kyiv. It is much more present if you are out near the front line. These drones are sort of constantly flying overhead. There's also some audio for what the attacks sound like. So I was in Kyiv on June, I believe it was 16th, which was one of the largest attacks of the war. And there's audio from that night of the attacks falling about 500 meters from my apartment in Kyiv to destroy parts of the Pechenska Lavra, which is the sort of religious center of Ukraine. It's a 1,000-year-old church. But there's also audio of what life is like in Kyiv beyond these attacks, you know, the sort of life that has to grow and move around these increasingly more common and frequent drone strikes. But you can't just hide in a shelter all day long.
Now, Australia, we're putting billions into both drones, but also counter-drone technology. What are we preparing for as a waterlogged country? How far can people fly drones into Australia? I'm imagining people in another country trying to fly drones into here, but that's probably not how that would work, right?
Well, it's important to remember drones aren't just limited to the air. There are ground drones. There are, and I think much more importantly to Australia, marine drones. So what Australia is preparing for, particularly in Pillar 2 of the AUKUS deal, most listeners will be aware of Pillar 1, which is the sort of attempted acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines from the United States. Pillar 2 involves building these autonomous marine drones as the next generation of Australia's shoreline defense. And these drones, these marine drones, are already being used quite frequently across the Pacific, specifically in the South China Sea, where just a couple of weeks ago, a private marine drone was able to get pretty close to a Chinese warship about 100 kilometers off the coast of the Philippines, very nearly sparking a conflict between the Chinese Navy and the Philippines. So these drones are going to become incredibly important to Australia's defense, but also raise a very big question of now that military hardware is so much cheaper and so much easier to operate, there will be institutions and actors other than national navies and armies that are able to use them, and we haven't yet been able to deal with that question.
How comfortable are we being responsible for autonomous drones making decisions that could ultimately end with conflict with other countries?
There is no law around this. There is no law in the civilian space. There is no international law. There is certainly no doctrine that is coming out about this decision-making that autonomous weapons are able to create. This is something that countries are going to have to put forward in terms of their own military doctrine to say these are the ways that we will use these weapons. But also international courts and international law are going to need to develop these cases to be able to assign responsibility. This is something that American weapons manufacturers are very active in on the marketing side to say that they and the people that buy them are not responsible for when these autonomous weapons are used in lethal scenarios. The first time, and I think the case that will come to define this this entire conversation was earlier this year when the U.S. used an LLM, so another version of AI, to decide targeting practices, which ended up in the bombing of a girls' school in Iran, killing 170 young women. That was a use of autonomous technology in the military space, and it began this big debate about who was responsible for that targeting and ultimately for the death of 170 civilians. We have to work this out. We have to have a public conversation around what we will allow our governments to do, because lethal force is probably the most powerful thing that any government has in their disposal. And we don't have democratic rules right now about how we want our governments to use them.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, we currently have more regulation around what an everyday consumer can do with a low-level drone, where they can fly it, than we do around what our military can do, or any military can do, with an autonomous weapon drone.
We have more regulation around how hairdressers are certified than we do around autonomous weapons.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And look, drones can do some fun stuff too. I know that they're being used for some very dark purposes these days. But Corey, tell me about a cool, fun, interesting, wonderful thing that you have seen a drone do.
Medical delivery. You know, they're obviously on the front line, but I think that's going to become increasingly relevant here in Australia to be able to deliver things like antivenoms and antidotes in places where humans can't always, you know, quickly reach. That has the capacity to save so many lives and to really get things, to get medicine and to get supplies where they need to go. So that's been inspiring me. That's been a useful use of the technology to me.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Corey. Lee, tell me about a cool thing that a drone can do.
Mobile cell towers. So this will be more of a thing as bushfire season heats up, but the idea of actually using it does exist, a drone as sort of like a mobile cell tower. So flying one into a position and all of a sudden extending your 4G and 5G coverage to places that don't normally get it. And we talk about mobile reception all the time in Australia because it's so important and parts of Australia just don't get it. Doesn't matter what we do. But when we're talking about emergency situations, there's nothing you can do because the towers are likely down and there is a fire in between them. But you can fly a drone in those situations that actually does work as a tower to kind of bounce signals. And that is really exciting.
That is fantastic. I have learned something today. Lee Stark, technology journalist from picker.com.au. Thank you for joining us on Download This Show.
Always happy to help. Kind of terrified by today's show.
And Corey Alford, researcher at the University of Melbourne, former Biden White House staffer who spent the last few months in Ukraine. Thank you for joining us on the program and telling us all about the things that you've seen.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.